Okay.
It is recording.
Hello, this is Kevin McClatchy, and today is July 28th, 2011. And I'm interviewing Dr. Kenneth Harris, current mayor of Slippery Rock Borough, and professor emeritus of Slippery Rock University. This interview is for the Rock Voices Oral History Project of Slippery Rock University. Dr. Harris, could you please give me some background information, biographical information, your full name, date of birth, where you're from originally?
Sure. I'm Ken Harris, as you now know. I was born in London, England, on August 11th, 1936. We came to America with my family in 1948. I went to school in West Orange, New Jersey, then Kenilworth, New Jersey, then off to college up in Maine, and eventually Iowa for graduate school.
What part of England was it?
London.
Do you have any recollections of what America, your first impressions were like when you first arrived?
I had a strange first impression of America. I was sick. We came over by boat, and it was winter time. Terrible, terrible crossing. It was very rough. We were on a nice luxury liner, but it was a rough crossing in January of 48, and I was sick, so they kept me in my cabin, and I wasn't able to get up on deck or even look out the window and see the Statue of Liberty. Everybody wants to see.
Oh, gosh.
Every immigrant wants to see the Statue of Liberty. Well, I didn't. I was 11 years old. I really wanted to see that statue. I was too sick. But my first memory was driving up the, the drive road alongside the Hudson River. Hudson River Drive.
Oh, yeah, that sounds right.
And the elevated highway there, and looking across the Hudson River, and there were huge ice floes floating down the river. You could almost have walked across the Hudson. Really nasty weather.
Yeah, that's unusual. Right?
Yeah, it really is, even today.
And before you came to Slippery Rock, could you give us a little of that background right before you came here, or how you came here to Slippery Rock?
Yeah, well, I answered an ad in the Chronicle of Higher Education and got the job. Some people really, those ads work for some people. I'm a testimonial to that. I was teaching a theater in a one-person theater and everything else, English, speech, whatever they needed, in a one-person department at Alderson Broads College in Philippi, West Virginia. And I was looking for someplace else to go and answered the ad, and here I am.
What year was that?
1981.
And what were your impressions of the town and the school, your first impressions?
Well, I want to be brutally frank here. I remember going home from the first interview before they said, we'd like to make you an offer. And I said to my wife, Nancy, this was down in West Virginia, I said, Nancy, it won't be the worst thing in the world if they don't make me an offer. I really wanted to get away from where I was. A one-person department is something that it's fine when you're 26, 27, 28 years old, but I was somewhat removed from that age, and I really wanted to work with a larger department, and Slippery Rock was it. But the town was not too impressive. The campus was clean and tidy, but it was clear that there hadn't been any building done in 18 or 20 years. The place was sort of at a standstill in terms of development. And Miller Auditorium, where I would work, and did work, of course, left a lot to be desired as a theater. It was and is a multi-purpose auditorium that had to serve a whole lot of different needs. It wasn't really built as a theater. And so, as I say, when I went home, after the first round of interviews, I said, you know, Nancy, it won't be the worst thing if they don't make me an offer. Mm-hmm. Of course, they did make me an offer, and I learned to love it here.
Yeah, that's good. So how large was the department back in 81?
Well, when I first came, we were part of the speech or communication department, really. And theater, there were four or five people in the department of communication who did theater from time to time. But less than a year after I came here, we had a kind of amicable divorce. And then President Reinhardt decreed that theater would be a new department, and we moved across campus from Eisenberg classroom into Sheehy and began in the fall of 82 it was the fall of 81 we began setting up the new department.
Oh, okay.
There were four of us.
And did that go relatively smoothly, or did...
Well, there were struggles. For one thing, they didn't give us a secretary for the first year or year and a half. We had to do all of the paperwork ourselves. This is in addition to teaching and play production,
yeah,
and everything else. And it took a while to get the resources we needed to make things happen. There were, I suspect, some mixed feelings about whether we were ready to be a new department. There were several who were absolutely for it. They were ready to go 2 years before I came, maybe more.
Yeah.
And others who thought, we need to get a few more things in place before we cut off all support from another department, from the administrative support we had from communication.
Yeah.
But there we were on our own, and we made the best of it.
Yeah. Now, I know that it was still a state college up till 83.
That's correct, yes.
So was that behind some of the thinking of changing the major? Or was it a major even back then?
It wasn't even a major, no. Yeah. We had to create a major whole hog from nothing.
Yeah.
When we were in communication, we did a lot of teaching of speech. In fact, I taught initially here more speech than I did theater. So breaking away was an opportunity to create a speech department, a theater department, and, mm-hmm. and we did.
Mm-hmm. I'll probably go back to
theater
department,
yeah,
but I'm just curious, do you remember that transition from the state college to the university in general, how that went about? Was it?
Oh, not terribly. I mean, it was festive. There were, there was a big event and a lot of hoopla around it, but I think we were all very busy in our department, trying to get a curriculum approved, trying to produce plays. And as the custodians at the multi-purpose auditorium where the music department performed, the dance department performed, the visiting artists came and did their performances, we were continuously busy.
Right, yeah. I imagine, yeah.
There wasn't much time to sit back and reflect. I wish now that I'm trying to write some of my own history about Slippery Rock and the university, I paid a little closer attention to those transitions. They're really interesting times.
Right.
But we were busy.
Yeah, I can imagine. You mentioned the buildings, some of the buildings. Were there any other buildings you worked in?
Eisenberg. I worked in Maltby in Sheehy Theater, a little theater downstairs.
Oh, right.
Which is still in use, and I did at least one, maybe two, one play there anyway.
Do you remember your first play?
The first play I directed. Yeah, the first play I directed was Equus.
Oh, right.
Drama.
I'm familiar.
And, it's
a great play.
Play. It was a good production. Laurie Stepanian gave us a terrific set revolved and had lots of interesting scenery. It was a dynamic show.
Yeah.
I thought to myself when I picked it, I'm going to take a chance on this play because it's got some bold bold stuff in it. And if they're going to fire me for the kind of plays I'm choosing, they're going to do it right away. And I'll get the picture right away. And, They didn't fire me. The play went over very well.
Oh, great.
So I knew things were going to be okay.
Could you talk a little bit more about some of the other productions? What were maybe your favorite productions?
Well, you know, students used to ask me this too. They used to quiz us getting into the honorary that they were part of, and what's your favorite production? And I had a stock answer for them. I'd say, the production I'm working on right now is my favorite. And in a way, I meant it, because you have to be committed to what you're doing now. You know, the play you're working on, that you have to get over the one that wasn't so good, the one before that that was brilliant, and so on, and imagine what you're going to make of the one that you're working on now. But I'm kind of always been partial to Tally's Folly that we did in the mid-80s. It was beautiful, lovely production. Just two characters in it, but we had a gorgeous set, wonderful actors, and just a really nice, sensitive, unimprovable production.
Oh, nice.
I liked Arcadia that we did late in my career, and an Our Town that was kind of experimental.
Right.
Our Town, you know, is written for maybe 30 or so named characters, and then 10 or 15, 20, whatever it is, extras who are not named.
Yeah. That's a big cast. Yeah.
I did it with 7 actors.
Wow.
Doing everything.
And wow.
They switched roles, they switched genders, and it was very, very dynamic, wonderful, I thought, wonderful production.
Nice. Yeah.
Really very happy with it.
Yeah. How would you categorize your style?
Eclectic. I like all kinds of theater. I did musicals, did an opera here. We did The Marriage of Figaro in collaboration with music department, and that was a good production too. And I liked poetic plays, Shakespeare. I did Romeo and Juliet. Mm. I did silly, frothy, you know, farces.
Right.
I suppose I characterized my style, with maybe the exception of Our Town, where I really moved in opposite direction from what I thought the playwright wanted. As a director who wanted to do plays close to what a playwright would have imagined when he or she wrote the piece. So by and large, I was honest to what I could detect of the playwright's intentions, rather than putting Ken Harris into the play.
Right.
With the possible exception of Our Town, where I put me into it.
Sounds like you would have to.
Actor, I wasn't on stage, but as a vision of how to make this play look and feel and sound completely different from the way anybody else had ever imagined it before.
Yeah. Right.
And that was great fun. I enjoyed doing that immensely.
Yeah. This is making me think of how you even got involved with theater to begin with.
That goes way back to my school days in England. A teacher in a play, I guess I must have been 9 or 10 years old, cast me in a class play. This was in 1946. It was right after the Second World War. And schools were starting to do normal things again, instead of, you know, kind of being careful and attentive to the fact that there was a war going on and we were getting bombed and had to run to air raid shelters and so on. But I got cast as a Chinaman. Can you imagine? I had a lot more red hair than I have now. And I played a Chinaman in this really interesting Chinese-style production. Well, there was a competition in London County Council schools, and by golly, our play, I forget even what it was called, our play went to the citywide championship final round.
Amazing.
And it was an age group competition, so we weren't competing against older or younger kids. We got to perform this Chinese play, in English, of course. We got to perform this play in Covent Garden Theatre, one of the most prestigious, important theatres at the time in London. And, you know, here I'm 9, 10 years old, I'm on stage in this fabulous facility, and I still remember vividly what it was like. And that would have been in 1946.
Wow.
And I think I got the bug at that point.
Right, I could see why. Yeah, that's impressive.
It's classic, the classic romantic story. You get in a play and you recognize this is something you want to stay with.
Right. And was there someone that was instrumental in making you choose acting, or did you just seem to have the inclination on your own?
I suppose the teacher of that class, and I don't remember his name, was just singling out people for assignment to be in this play.
Yeah.
We did it first for the school, and then later entered in the competition.
Oh, nice. And then you were off to... America, of course, and then to college. Were you involved in theater in college? Or?
I went off to college as a chemistry major. I'd had a wonderful chemistry class in high school and thought, I'm going to be a chem major. But modern chemistry in 1954, when I went off to college, had changed radically from the kind of chemistry that had been taught in my high school. And it was very mathematical and theoretical. And while I could do the math, I was painfully slow at it. And I think after my freshman year, I recognized that competitively I was going to be perpetually behind if I stayed in chemistry. This is, by the way, before they had handheld calculators. I had to do all the math on a slide rule, and that was horrific. Instrument of torture, the slide rule. So anyway, I had been to see a play at the college theater and liked it. It was Stalag 17, a prisoner of war comedy drama, and I thought, gosh, they did a wonderful job on it. I'd like to get involved. And when it became clear that the chem lab was not going to be the place where I'd spend a career, I'm casting about for things to do on campus, I tried out for the play.
Now that was Bates College?
That was Bates College in Maine.
Yeah. Nice, and then it was off to graduate school. And
went to University of Iowa, the graduate school. Terrific program in theater that prepared you very well for the first job I had. They were training multiply skilled generalists. They've changed their model now. They're not doing that anymore. But at the time I went there, it was in the late 50s, 58, 59. They were training generalists, and that worked well for my very first job because I had to do everything at Alders and Broaddus. Lights, sound, costumes, makeup. I had to learn a lot about makeup, as well as directing the plays, and of course teaching all about them.
Yeah.
And Iowa gave me just enough work in speech, and particularly in speech science, the anatomy, physiology of speech, that I felt very comfortable in the speech classroom too, and it was exactly what AB College needed.
Yeah.
And then when I came up here, that multiple training kept me versatile enough so that I could fit in not exactly every place that it was needed, but if somebody else in the department couldn't or wouldn't do something, Ken Harris got to do it.
Yeah. We covered your first impressions of the university. Is there anything else you want to say that regarding the theater department that reminiscing about it, or some of your best and worst teaching moments, something like
that? I can remember some worst play production moments. I designed three sets, for a production of Dracula. Laurie Stepanian, who was a far better designer than me, was directing it, and I drew the task of doing the scenery. And it was a very elaborate production. Besides having to change three sets on a stage, it wasn't really built for doing that very well. Laurie wanted a lot of special effects. I remember she wanted a bat flying through, not across the stage, but across the auditorium from the back wall of the auditorium. She wanted it to fly over the heads of the audience. And we tried rigging that to make something work, and it was clear it wasn't going to work. And we did get a bat, not a real one, of course, a theater bat, to fly across the stage from left to right. But I remember, I forget whether it was opening night or which night it was of the performance, we did four performances in those days. One of the actors strode to a door to walk out, and the door came off in his hands.
Oh, no.
The audience thought that was very, very funny, and I'm at the back of the auditorium slumping down into my chair thinking, what have I done? And I felt so sorry for Laurie, but, you know, the damage was done.
That was at Miller Auditorium?
That was at Miller, yeah.
You just made me think I'd come across something in the Rocket where... occasionally, it seemed that play would have to be canceled because it might be playing on Broadway. It seemed that I thought it said something.
Yeah, we had at least one show there, and I really wanted to do it. It was The Blood Knot by Athol Fugard, a South African play. Terrific play. I admire Fugard immensely, and I really like that play. But we switched to... something else and made that work. The play was unavailable because it was to be revived, I think, off Broadway rather than Broadway, but revived in New York anyway. And the royalty or leasing companies that give you license permission, for which you pay, to do the play lawfully, withdrew the permission at the last minute. We had to find something else. That's occasionally a problem in the non-professional theater because the professional rights trump what they like to call the amateur rights. I never used to think of myself as an amateur, but it was certainly non-professional. And the professional rights in general trump the amateur rights. So it still happens now and then.
And we can talk a little bit about the highlights, some of the best of your teaching or theater.
Well, I like both. The challenge in play production, you're there every night for 5-6 weeks in play production and you're exhausted for about a week or so afterwards, is keeping up with the classwork. And so sometimes you're running on fumes, you know, on memory of how you did this the last time. It's one of the vulnerabilities of teaching in a discipline like theater, where a once-a-week rehearsal or a twice-a-week rehearsal is not possible or practical. You have to work every day. It's to get that memory traces set so that the lines for the actors and the cues for the technicians and so forth work perfectly when the audience is there. But it's very demanding, play production. And so now and then you would go into a classroom because you didn't stop teaching in class just because you had play rehearsals going on, and find that the students were maybe a page or a chapter ahead of you. And you had to kind of work that out as best you can. Fortunately, in a four-person theater department, it was always somebody else. When you weren't doing a play, that somebody else was doing it. So you would get a break between your plays to be better prepared. And that was of course a big help.
Yeah.
But you had to fight against the. Inclination or the channel, the temptation is a better word. You had to fight against the temptation to use last year's material or work with notes that you'd made 5 or 8 years ago. And you'd overcome that maybe 80% of the time, but now and then, out of necessity, when you were up till 11, 12, 1 a.m. the previous night, and you had an 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. class, you know, and you would be, it would be a struggle the next day sometimes.
The quality of the student in your theater department, how did you find the talent?
The best of them are terrific. There's some really very fine, talented students here. Ones who come here intending to do theater or performance work, and then others who discover they have an ability perhaps they never thought of until they find themselves in a play. And generally, if you only cast those people, you could look very, very good. But for the development of a program and in order to choose an interesting mix of plays, you have to take chances now and then on people whose work you don't know. It's not like Broadway where everyone there is already highly skilled and professionally accredited and so on. You ask people to step up and take a role and they do it. And if it doesn't always work out perfectly, why, you have to live with the results. And that happened now and then. Perhaps I'd rather not mention names of plays or people, but now and then you'd find yourself wishing you'd made a different casting decision. Right. But the secret of success in college and university theater is casting. It's picking the play that can be done well by the age of students that you've got, and then motivating and casting the right people to do it as well as possible.
Maybe we go to the university in general here.
Sure.
To topic.
Yeah.
When you were here, can you think about some of the leaders, the presidents, the deans, when you first came to campus, some of the old timers, the movers and shakers?
Sure. Well, I remember vividly my immediate predecessor, Milt Carlos. Milt was head of the program while it was still part of the communication department. And Milt stayed with communication the year after we were created as a separate department. But that was his last or next to last year of teaching. And I remember how much he was looking forward to retirement. Unfortunately, he didn't. He got sick and died about a year after he retired. But I remember learning a lot from him about how the university, or it was college then, how the college worked. And he was helpful on introducing me to the habits and foibles of people who I didn't know, but I had to work with. The president of the college then was Herb Reinhardt. And Herb had some interesting dynamics with regard to theater. Herb liked to invite special guests, trustees typically, but people of influence, to the final dress rehearsal of the big musical. We were doing a musical almost every year when I first came here, or Milton had been doing a musical. And the first musical I was here for was Fiddler on the Roof. And I got a call from Herb about how he wanted this final dress rehearsal to go, and I went back to Milt to check with him about who this guy Herb Reinhardt was and what he expected, and Milt said, well, you need to be careful about President Reinhardt. He will ask you, and he did, to interrupt the dress rehearsal. Now Milt understood, and I did, that that's not what you want to do. Working professional, mature adult performers could handle that kind of thing very easily. But we're working with, 18, 19-year-olds, some of whom never been on the stage before.
Right.
And Dr. Reinhardt wanted the rehearsal interrupted so that the director, I forget, it was Tim Walters, or I think Tim Walters directed Fiddler on the Roof rather than Milt Carlos. Milt was there, but I think Tim, maybe they co-directed it. Or anyway, Dr. Reinhardt wanted the rehearsal interrupted so that the trustees could see what a director did. You know, giving instructions, changes, try it this way, try it that way. Well, we worked out exactly how we were to, they were going to do it. It was no longer an issue of trying it. It was making it run smoothly and coherently. So
right,
it all
the dress rehearsal you would hope.
Yeah. So we had to kind of wire around Dr. Reinhardt's fondness for interrupting rehearsals. And what we did, knowing it was coming, was stage a moment where something would go wrong.
Oh, really?
And the actors and the technicians and the stage managers all knew exactly where we were going to interrupt the show. And we interrupted it right on schedule. I mean, we were nothing if not obedient.
That's great.
We interrupted it. We interrupted it on schedule, and it was very scripted. And I don't know whether Dr. Reinhardt ever realized that, but it was carefully planned so that we could maintain as much as we could the coherence, the confidence of a cast that needed to know we can get through this long, complex musical without any interruptions.
Yeah. And now after Reinhardt left, how was the administration in terms of dealing with the theater department?
Yeah, we got along fine with Dr. Ebersold, but you always sensed with Bob that while he was cordial, helpful, clear, articulate, friendly, I never had any difficulties with him, that the theater vocabulary, I'm talking about theater administrative, not artistic, but administrative vocabulary, was something that wasn't always there. We needed to explain things. Whereas when Warren Smith came as the next full-time successor president, I remember to this day, Warren wanted a tour through Miller Auditorium. I didn't know much about him then, but he walked, I met him on schedule, and we walked through the auditorium, and he took a couple of looks around, and he asked me questions about the performance space. The proscenium arch, he mentioned, I remember that vividly. And I recognized at that moment that here was a guy who, he was a chemist, an organic chemist, but he knew about performance spaces. And he recognized some of the complications of Miller Auditorium right away. And I said to myself, and wound up saying to the rest of the department faculty, here's a guy who understands the complications we face in dealing with this unique building. Mm-hmm. I think we'll find him a friend of theater. And indeed we did.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Smith, too. Bob Smith is a former, is a communication faculty member. Yeah, he has his graduate degrees in communication, and he came from a university where theater and communication were all part of the same department. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I saw his resume, I knew that Bob Smith was someone who understood the issues we had to deal with administratively,
mm-hmm.
Teaching loads, performance situations, the legal and economics, the legalities and economics of play production on a university campus. And sure enough, Bob knew that stuff down cold.
Right. There's sometimes we like to ask people that during your interim here, were there anything that happened in the worldwide events that affected the campus, or any storms, or anything that you can remember that was a little unusual when you look back on it, that while you were here?
We had lights go out one night at a play, and had to call off the play. There's an emergency lighting system in the auditorium, and still is, but it doesn't permit you to continue with a performance. There's not enough power to light the stage. You can just get everybody out safely. And we had to hustle everybody out. Sorry, folks, we'll do this play tomorrow night. I don't even remember. It wasn't one of my plays. I don't remember what it was, but we had to move everybody. We had to move everybody out while the emergency generator was still running. That was.
I guess it was not a lot of political activity with students. That had all passed.
That had pretty much passed. Right. We had. I remember political activity where I used to teach. I remember on the day of the Kent State shootings, for example, it was as close as we got to turmoil on our campus, tiny little campus down in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. But by 1981, I think people had begun to characterize things as silent generation or something. It was, I don't want to say politically incompetent or disconnected, but relatively passive.
Right. People probably just taking a rest after. Do you want to discuss any other memorable events you can think of? But memories besides the big things that happened
on the campus?
Yeah.
Well, I remember because it was a tragic event. The sudden onset of illness and death of our colleague Orly Holton.
Oh,
this was in 1994. Orly had been here much longer than I had. He was an internationally known expert on Henrik Ibsen, the Norwegian playwright, and. Orly knew Norwegian. He spoke and read it, and he was immersed in that. I remember vividly to this day, it was in 1994, in the January school, the semester had just started, and Orly walked into his office, and he walked into the door, literally, the door frame, the department secretary at that time said, "Ken, you better come over, something wrong with Orly." And he turned out to have a brain tumor, and 6 months later he was gone.
Sad situation, man.
So, you know, those are, that kind of vivid memory stays with you.
Right.
But there are happier memories too, of course.
Right.
I remember a really weird memory, and strange. It turned out to have a happy ending for us in the theater. We had a terribly old, patch panel or interconnect system at Miller Auditorium that had been there probably since the building was opened in the early 1960s. It was cross-connect panel. And we were having difficulty mechanically with it. And because it was electrical and the electricity was right behind a face of a Bakelite kind of material in we didn't want to play around with cleaning these sliders, mechanical sliders. It was not safe without an electrician coming and turning it off. So the university electricians came over, turned the system off, which we were not able to do at that time, and they removed the front cover to do the cleaning of these sliders. These were copper sliders, and a contact brush moved up and down the slider to make the connection between dimmer 25 and circuit 83 so that you could plug different circuits into different dimmers. When the electricians, bless their hearts, I mean that rather seriously, they finished the job. I'm not sure whether they did this out of generosity or ignorance, but they sprayed WD-40
right, cure of everything.
They sprayed WD-40 to keep the sliders clean and sliding. There's a lot of corrosion and just general dust and crud. Can I use that word? Well, I use it. Just general crud lining these mechanical sliders that moved the electricity from the dimmers to the lights. But when they re-energized the system, this lubricant was still over the, still on the sliders, and I was standing there when it spontaneously burst into flame. This whole thing just kind of exploded in wow. front of us. Now, fortunately, the fire was all contained to this patch panel, but the patch panel was wrecked. It was impossible to use it. And Bob Ebersole, bless his heart, we had a show opening. I forget what it was, a musical. We had a show, Charlie Brown? I don't remember. But we had a show opening in a week. And I got on the phone. I called the maintenance people first, the head of maintenance. What do we do? He said, talk to the president. I called Bob Ebersole. Bob said, come on up. Explained the situation. I think we took somebody from maintenance along to a firm that really was terrible news. The building was unusable. The lighting system was unusable. And Bob, without blinking an eyelash, came up with some money to rent us some new equipment. It was portable rental equipment. We had it in the next day.
Nice.
And it took some arm twisting. You know, the standard procurement and rental processes to make that happen. But it was an emergency, and Bob, I suspect, picked up the phone and said, theater needs this stuff, and they need it right away. Make it happen. And it did.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. But as a consequence of that, when the rental equipment went back, and I think we had it for maybe 5 or 6 months, we were well along for planning for a comprehensive replacement, and we got a terrific fine new system.
Oh, nice.
As a result of that fire.
Right. Now, I know, do you want to talk some more about reminiscent? I thought I might move on to after your retirement.
Sure.
I'm curious too about, I know you have a commitment to Slippery Rock Borough, you're the mayor.
Right.
And how that came about, or how you became interested in running. And
well, I didn't really run in a sense. It was the night, I still remember it rather clearly. It was the night before the closing of petitions. They were due in the next day. I didn't know this at the time, but there's a knock on the door. My wife and I are watching TV. At home, and a knock on the door, doorbell rang, and it was Royce Lawrence, who's a member of council to this day, and Royce said, Ken, would you consider running for mayor, petitioning for mayor? Nobody wants to be mayor, and we're afraid that if that continues like that, that a write-in vote of as few as 10 votes will name the next mayor.
Right.
And I mean no disparagement of college students, but it's not hard to imagine a group of college guys or gals thinking, you know, I could be the next mayor of Slippery Rock, and the mayor has charge of the police.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah. At least on paper, in theory, the mayor is in charge of the police.
Yeah.
And so I thought it over a little bit. I talked with Nancy, and I said eventually to Royce, okay, I'll do it. Well, I was unopposed. Nobody else wanted to do this. So getting the petition, I needed 15 signatures, and Royce and I think the late Jim Green now helped me, point me in the direction of some people who would sign the petitions. And we got the petitions in the next day before 4 o'clock deadline, and my name was on the ballot. My first two, I'm in my third term now. The first two terms I was unopposed, but the third term we actually really did have to campaign, and I won the election, a contested election. But I'm in the second year of my third term.
Okay.
I enjoy it immensely. Yeah. Yeah, it's
how long the term took?
4 years.
4 years, yeah.
4 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you know that the first mayor of Slippery Rock was a college or university, well, it was college then, faculty member. His name was Bill Storm, called Pop. And he was a coach and a phys ed teacher.
Right, that sounds right.
Pop Storer. I just learned this recently. I'm looking back, trying to recreate the list of mayors. Mayors are relatively new invention.
Yeah, I was going to say, because,
yeah, they were burgesses until 1959 or so. And I think the first election for a mayor was in 1960 or 61. And Storer, who had been a football coach here, very successful.
Right, I know the name, right.
And popular guy.
Right.
Ran and was elected mayor. So I'm by no means the first college-related, faculty person to be a mayor in Slippery Rock.
Yeah. How do you see the future for the campus and the borough?
I'm optimistic in general about things. I mean, there are always challenges. There's never enough money to do what you know needs to be done.
For the borough?
Well, probably both. Yeah. I mean, there are challenges facing the university now from budget perspectives. I know they're trying to build a new theater here, or at least a remodel Miller Auditorium, and finding the dollars for that in these days will be a great challenge. Mm-hmm. But it's similarly, we're challenged in the borough. We run the borough on about $1 million a year and change, and the tax base is pretty steady, but that means with inflation it gets harder to meet the rising cost of things with a fairly steady stream of income.
Right.
And so there are challenges getting things done.
Right. I know you were involved with the development.
Slippery Rock Development, that was the project that took the overhead wires and clutter off of Main Street and put new sidewalks and signs and new trees and kind of gussied up the place.
Right.
If Slippery Rock had looked like it did today in 1981, actually it was the fall of 1980 when I came up for my interview, I would never have had to go back to my wife and say, you know, it wouldn't be such a bad thing if I don't get this job.
Right.
I mean, Slippery Rock really was kind of dumpy and messy and tired, very tired. More than just fatigue, it looked almost terminally tired.
Right.
That
was my impression when I first came to the region. Right. And I agree with you totally. It was a terrific job.
Much of the planning had been done before I got to be mayor, but I was there to see the contract signed and be part of the group that oversaw that.
Mm-hmm.
They worked very hard and still are. That group is still meeting.
Right. And the university's involved with that too, right?
Yes, I will tell you that both Warren Smith, who's no longer on the committee, and Bob Smith, who is, have been fabulous aides to making that happen. John Bonando has been extremely helpful. And the university generally, the project wouldn't have happened without the university. That's crystal clear.
That's nice,
kind of heroic work. And money, there's university money, or rather foundation money, in the project, and lots of in-kind contributions. Talking about secretarial time and printing and telephoning mailing and
something you never think of.
Things you don't think of that help make the project go. Meeting places and time and lobbying. Both of the Dr. Smith, tireless in making that downtown redevelopment happen.
We had the new hotel.
Instrumental there too. Of course, we're facing not merely the prospect, the reality there'll be a new president here in a year, and we in the borough, I know, are hoping that the new president will have a you know, friendly and positive, supportive outlook on the relationship between the borough and the university, because we're like it or not, we're stuck here together, and we've got to work out ways to get along and to thrive, to prosper, because if we don't, we'll both hurt.
Well, I, you know, working in the archives, I know the story of how the university, the normal school, was founded, and how involved the community was.
Yeah,
and then that tradition lingers on.
Yeah, it was. You know, some of the people, their names were preserved on some of the buildings. I'm glad Patterson Hall is still here, because it was a Patterson who was instrumental, one of the key members of a committee that basically petitioned the legislature back in the late 1880s, I guess, to create a normal school here. The citizens wanted it because they wanted good teaching in their local schools, and this is the way you got it.
Right.
And it worked for them. So the college, subsequently the university, is created, literally created and funded initially. The first buildings are payment for the first buildings subscribed to by contributions and bonds that are underwritten by investors in the borough.
Right.
The community created the college.
I find that amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's a good story.
It's a good story,
yeah.
And true one.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a good point where we can close off this interview.
Kevin, it's great talking with you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.